Chapter 26, Restoring the Balance. My diary entry for the 1st of January 1966 was very different from my entry for the corresponding day of the previous year. This time there was no summary of my reflections on the recent history of British Buddhism, no expression of my hopes for the future, and no invocation of the blessings of the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Dakinis. There was only a record of the principal events of the day, as indeed there had also been in my entry for the last New Year's Day. That New Year's Day I had spent at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. It was a fairly typical day, in the course of which I had attended puja in the shrine room with the rest of our little monastic community, received an unexpected telephone call from an old friend, and seen members of the Sangha Association. This New Year's Day I spent with Terry at the flat, where I had in fact passed the night. The day was by no means a typical one, either for my friend or for me. My diary entry reads, "Got up at about midday, having spent the morning talking. At about 1 o'clock went and had lunch at the Indopac. First time I had been out in civilian clothes. Then down to George Cummins, where Terry collected a box of stuff from his former office. Looked down the Charing Cross Road for a jacket for me, but finally decided against getting one. Walked round Soho. Had a coffee. Did our shopping for the week, some of it in a street market. Stopped at Chalk Farm, where Terry collected his laundry. Looked round a second-hand bookshop. Terry bought a couple of paperbacks. Back to the flat. Terry found he had lost a black address book and thought it might still be at the office. Went back and searched, but without any success. Terry left a note for Alan. On returning to the flat, discovered the address book in a camera case. Spent the evening reading, talking, and listening to records. Terry still depressed on account of the circumstances of yesterday's farewell. There are several points here that require explanation. To begin with, there is the fact of my not getting up until about midday. By nature, I was, and still am, an early riser, and except for the rare occasions when I was ill, I had not spent a whole morning in bed since I was a teenager. Terry was an early riser too, though in his case this was due not so much to personal inclination as to the fact that for many years he had had a 9-to-5 job. Now that he had stopped working, he saw no reason why he should not spend the morning in bed if he wanted to, and I saw no reason why I should not follow suit. In both cases, there was an element of conscious rejection of a particular conditioning. What Terry was rejecting, in effect, was the Protestant work ethic in which he had been brought up, which was an integral part of a system and a way of life he had come to loathe, and according to which such minor indulgences as spending the morning in bed were not just wrong, but positively sinful. In my own case, I was rejecting the idea that as a Buddhist, and especially as a monk, it was necessary for me always to be leading a strictly disciplined life, as I had done for the last so many years. Not that I was disposed to question the value of discipline. Leading a disciplined life, working methodically, and following a regular routine were things that came easily and naturally to me, so that I was all the more aware of the danger of their becoming matters of fixed habit and of my becoming incapable, eventually, of functioning in any other manner. Discipline was a means to an end, not an end in itself. From time to time it was therefore necessary to go, prophylactically, to the opposite extreme, at least in small, harmless ways. Thus it was that on New Year's Day I did not get up until about midday, after Terry and I had spent the morning talking to each other across the room from our respective beds. Thus it was too that it was not until about 1 o'clock that we drove across to West Hampstead and had lunch at our favourite Indian restaurant. According to the Vinaya, it was an offence for a monk to partake of solid food after midday. In India, I had observed this rule strictly for a number of years, and it was official policy at the Hampstead Vihara. During the last few years of my stay in India, however, I had adopted a more flexible attitude, especially when on tour among the newly converted Indian Buddhists. Though I continued to observe the 12 o'clock rule, as some of my bhikkhu friends jocularly called it, during the 4 months of the Rains residence, when I immersed myself in study, meditation and literary work, and did not go beyond the gate of my small hillside monastery. But regardless of whether I did or did not partake of solid food after midday, it was clear to me that the principle, as distinct from the rule, was moderation in eating, and that this was a principle to be honoured by monk and layman alike. Though it was an offence for a monk to eat after midday, it was a very minor offence, and one that could be expiated by formal confession to a fellow monk. Theravadin layfolk, who generally were ignorant of the Vinaya, tended to regard the offence as a serious one, sometimes even going so far as to equate it with the infinitely more serious offence of engaging in sexual intercourse with a woman, which automatically entailed permanent expulsion from the monastic community. Had a Theravadin layman, especially one of the older generation, happened to see me eating in the Indo-Pakistan restaurant that afternoon, he or she would have been deeply shocked. He would have been still more shocked to see me wearing civilian clothes. That is to say, he would have been shocked had it been possible for him to believe the evidence of his senses and not think, as he was almost bound to think, that it was a case of mistaken identity on his part. Back in his own Sri Lanka or Burma or Thailand, it was unthinkable that a monk should ever wear civilian clothes. There, a monk was one who wore the yellow robe, and one who wore the yellow robe was a monk. So that despite what the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, verse 142, one who is not wearing the robe could not possibly be a monk, and therefore the person seen in the restaurant, in this particular instance, could not possibly have been wearing civilian clothes and have been the Venerable Sangharakshita. In India, I had not once thought of wearing civilian clothes, that is, not since my going forth into the homeless state, and especially not since my formal ordination as a Buddhist monk. I always felt quite at home in the yellow robe, and in any case, in the socio-religious context within which I was then living and working, the question of my wearing anything other than a robe simply did not arise. People may have been somewhat surprised initially to see a Westerner wearing the yellow robe of the renunciant, but they at least knew what the robe signified, so that even though it happened to be a stranger who was the bearer of the message itself was a perfectly familiar one, and communication between us could, therefore, be easily established. In England, in Great Britain, the situation was entirely different. There the yellow robe did not signify anything, though the shaven head, if one did not wear a beri in public, as Ratanasara did, might convey a suggestion of something vaguely medieval and ascetic. My mother's friends had shown no surprise at my yellow robe, not only out of English politeness, but because she had already told them all about me. But this was exceptional. Even in cosmopolitan London, I had to put up with some strange looks, even with the occasional rude comment when travelling by bus or tube, especially if I happened to be on my own. Some people seemed to think I was in fancy dress, others that I was wearing a sari underneath my cloak, or even that I was a transvestite. Thus it was with a distinct feeling of relief that for the first time in nearly 20 years I went out in civilian clothes. It was a relief to be able to walk down Charing Cross Road and round Soho and to have a cup of coffee without being stared at or feeling I was being looked at out of the corner of somebody's eye. I have known Western Buddhist monks who did not mind being intruded on in this way, and who, in the case of one or two of them, not only enjoyed being the object of so much attention, but flaunted themselves in their yellow robes in a manner that was calculated to attract it. I was of a very different temperament from such exhibitionists. Far from wanting to attract attention, I sought to avoid it as much as possible. I wanted to be free to go about my occasions without being taken particular notice of by anybody. I wanted to be inconspicuous, to be lost in the crowd, to be the observer rather than the observed. I was certainly inconspicuous that afternoon as I walked round central London in my civilian clothes. I was wearing a pair of grey flannel trousers I had bought in Cambridge a few weeks earlier, together with a tweed sports jacket belonging to Terry. The jacket fitted me perfectly, as did the shirt, complete with sober tie, that went with it, for my friend was narrow-shouldered for his height, which was well above average. Terry was pleased to see me in civilian clothes, for he was one of those who believed that such oriental trappings as yellow robes had nothing to do with the actual study and practice of the Buddha's teaching, and could, in fact, be an obstacle to its being taken seriously by intelligent people. For my part, I felt less strange in civilian clothes than I had expected to be, given the length of time that had elapsed since I last wore them. And soon I felt as much at home in jacket and trousers as I did in robes, besides being more comfortable in them when it was a question of going out and about. Not that I very often went out in civilian clothes. I went out in them only occasionally, and even then only with Terry, and more often than not, we would be driving around in a little bus rather than walking or using public transport. Nobody at the Hampstead Vihara knew that I sometimes wore civilian clothes, with the possible exception of Eric, whom I may have told. Had the more decidedly Theravadin members of the Sangha Association known, they would have been scandalised, for thanks to the efforts of a succession of Sinhalese, Thai and Thailand-returned bhikkhus, the minds of a section of the British Buddhist community were already imbued with the formalistic notions that prevailed in the Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia. As for the other members of the association, most, I suspect, would not have objected to my wearing civilian clothes sometimes, any more than most members of the Buddhist society would have done. According to Christmas Humphreys, the true Buddhist was one who wore the yellow robe within, a favourite phrase of his. And probably he and his colleagues at the society would have preferred to see Western monks wearing ordinary Western dress rather than going about in what the average Englishman, and even the average English Buddhist, could not but regard as outlandish costume. My finally deciding against getting myself a jacket, when Terry and I looked down Charing Cross Road for one, was certainly not owing to any shortage there either of clothing shops or jackets. Rather was the opposite the case. There were several such shops, and in each shop there were so many jackets of so many different sizes, colours, materials, styles and prices, that in the end, unable to make up my mind which one to choose, I decided to put off the whole perplexing business to another day, with the result that several years were to pass before I actually bought myself a jacket. My indecisiveness was due in part to the fact that, as a monk, I was not used to buying my own clothes. One's yellow robes were provided by the laity, and were always of the same traditional pattern. In part to the fact that I had been away so long that I had no idea what sort of clothes would be suitable for someone of my age and position, or lack of position, and neither Terry nor the shop assistants were able to give me much help in this connection. While I had experienced no difficulty in adjusting psychologically to being back in Britain, the truth of the matter was that living, as I did, in the esoteric enclave that was the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, I had little knowledge of what life in the workaday world outside was really like. Not only did I have no idea what sort of clothes to buy, during the week's shopping and collecting laundry, as Terry and I did after walking round Soho and having a coffee, were novel experiences for me, the more especially as some of that shopping was done in a crowded and noisy street market, and I had not set foot in a laundrette before. To my friend, of course, such tasks as shopping and collecting one's laundry were only too familiar, and it was thanks to him that, as the weeks and months went by, These and 100 other concomitants of modern living became familiar to me, or became less unfamiliar. It was Terry, more than anyone else, in fact, who enabled me to make the transition to living in England, as distinct from living at the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara. Just as 20 years ago, it had been the then Robin Banerjee who enabled me to make the transition to living in India. And for me, at least, this was an important element in our friendship. The last point that requires explanation in my diary entry for New Year's Day relates to the fact that in the evening, Terry was still feeling depressed. He was depressed, as the entry itself indicates, on account of the circumstances of the send-off his colleagues at the advertising agency had given him the previous evening. This had been a boisterous, alcoholic affair. He had not looked forward to it, and returned to the flat slightly drunk and wanting to talk. It was not the boisterousness, or even the freely flowing alcohol, that had disturbed him, so much as his being there and what he felt were completely false pretenses. Though he had worked for the agency for a number of years and was regarded as a popular figure, none of his colleagues really knew him, so that the good old Terry, who was the recipient of their hearty, if alcoholic, good wishes for the future, was not he, but a totally different person. They knew nothing of his problems, nothing of his aspirations, and did not understand why, at the age of 30, he was leaving a well-paid job in order, apparently, to study philosophy. Another source of Terry's depression was the fact of his having been unable to make a short speech acknowledging his colleague's good wishes, as was customary on such occasions. He had made a few notes beforehand, and indeed tried to speak, but after stammering out a few words, he was so overcome by anxiety and was sweating so profusely that he was obliged to stop and sit down. He sat down amid applause, his colleagues thinking he had simply had too much to drink. But Terry knew better. For him, therefore, his failure to rise to the occasion was a deeply humiliating experience, and one that served to reinforce the inferiority and anxiety he often felt in social situations.